I'm here in Belgrade and I'm talking to Richard Farley, who was born in 1928, and I'm also talking to John Sexton. John, you're a much younger man and came in much later, but can I start with you, Richard? The Farleys, where are they from originally? Where did your people come from?
From County Meath.
And what brought them to Dublin?
Well, I don't know. I was born in Offaly in Edenderry. My father was a butcher by trade. He came to Edenderry and was working as a butcher. I was born, as I say, in Edenderry. I went to school in Edenderry up to primary. After primary, of course, at that time, there was no secondary. There was, I think at that time, it was a technical school. And that was in Tullamore, about 26 miles, 27 miles away. So, of course, with no transport, I never got any further than national school education.
And what did you do after school then?
Well, at 14, I went to work for my father in the butchery, to serve my time to the butchers. I spent a few years there, and I don't know if my father sacked me one Friday night.
Why did he do that,
though? I don't think I could. I know this lady came in looking for what you call beef, be the beef suet, S-U-I-T. It was people used for, at that time, for if to put on a roast, if you were cooking, instead of lard that they have nowadays or whatever they want. I took the kidney out of the hind quarter of beef. I took the suet out and she tried to tell me that it wasn't beef suet. I asked her if it wasn't beef suet, what the F did she think it was? My father was out the back, walked in and heard me saying it that night. He said, "Dick, you're not coming to the butcher anymore." On the Monday morning, he arranged me to go across the road and start serving my time to the bar. Not legally now, the pub.
Yes, indeed. And so you worked there. What was the name of the pub there?
Patterson's of Edenderry. Yeah. There were general merchants at that time. There were pubs, groceries, undertakers, seed merchants, you name it, they were it. After that, I came from there to Ratcool in 1945 to the Ratcool Inn, better known as Roach's. I was 16, I think, 16 and a half at that time. I worked in Roach's for about 3 or 4 years, and then I went to work in Swiftbrook Paper Mills. Am I cutting it too, Shay, all right?
Oh, no, this is fascinating.
I went to work in Swiftbrook in 1951.
Who was managing Swiftbrook at the time?
A gentleman by the name of Mr. Halsburg. Well, he was the owner.
And was there many staff there? What was it like when you went there in 1951?
At that 1951, there was 250 people working there.
And what did you go in doing?
I just went in as a worker in Arnie. I went in to work in the mill on one of the machines.
Yeah. But can you describe it to me?
Swiftbrook was a very old building. The McDonald's were there for years. It was one of the oldest mills, I think, in the country, Tommy. I think I'm right there.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very old building. They had three machines, number one, two, and number three. Number one used to make all the government contracts, like Uffigan Ta Láthair was the name of the paper. That was the official government paper.
What was it called?
Uffigan Ta Láthair.
Okay.
The stationery office.
I won't ask you to spell that.
No. I was commonly known as Saggart as Black Saggart. Why did they call it Black Saggart? I don't know, but that's what the local lads call it.
Yeah.
Number two machine made all the Swiftbrook bonds and all the finer papers, including sweep, this paper for the sweep at that time. At one time, I believe, before my time, they made the postage, the paper for the post, for the stamps.
Oh, yes. Stamp paper.
Stamp paper, yes. They made all the fine papers on number two. And number three, then, they made all the better known as bank papers or lightweight, which would be used in copies and stuff, school books and stuff like that. When I went in, I worked on number two machine as a sizer man. It was this, the paper came down from the wet end, as they call it, onto some cylinders, and then it came into this sizer, which put a coating on it, in one end and out the other, and then out into dryers.
Yeah.
They made a huge array of papers.
Watermarking paper.
Watermark, yes.
Yes, did you do that?
We did. And there was a rule in the JA rule book that if you used any correspondence for any business whatsoever, you must do it on an Irish watermark paper, which generally would have been either on Swiftproof Bond or Ancient Irish Vellum. If you didn't have it on an Irish watermark paper, your correspondence was deemed out of order and wouldn't be listened to.
This is extraordinary. So this is something that had to be done. If you sent a letter to the GAA, it had to be written
on watermark paper. The smallest little club in the country.
Yes,
right.
If you're objected to a minor player playing overage, it had to be on an Irish watermark paper.
Oh, that's terrific, yeah. But your job as a sizer, was it just
taking the paper, putting it through this tub?
Yes.
Very complicated.
Yeah, but it must, you know, at that time, was it a busy place? Was the place...
Oh, very busy. It was three shifts. 6 to 2, 2 to 10, and 10 to 6, night shift.
Were, you know, the staff there that worked there, were they all from the locality? Were they local people mostly?
I would say 80% would be locally, yeah. And some of them would be, went as far as Selbridge, came from Selbridge.
Yeah.
I think that was out the furthest. Well, of course, from Dublin, yeah. From town.
Yes. And so was there a bus provided to bring...
Oh, no, you made your own way.
Bicycles.
A bus? You must be joking.
So,
and you had to be on time.
Yeah.
You had to clock in and clock out like as you would in most factories. And smoking was taboo. You were not allowed to smoke on the premises. There was a very hard regime there. If you were caught smoking, you, to use an old saying, you didn't get time to get your coat.
Yes.
You were told go home and send on your cards. I always remember one particular case of the foreman, Redger McDermott, he was, spent half the night up trying to sort out what they call a beater. This was a machine that beat the pulp, into pulp sort of thing, that was one of the main ingredients in the paper.
Yeah.
And he spent a couple of hours out trying to get this machine sorted. In the meantime, Mr. Hosbrook came up, found two lads outside the door smoking in the yard, sacked them, stayed away, came in and sacked the foreman as well, sent them home.
But they were that strict, were they, the management, on smoking?
If you were caught smoking, you were gone. You had no comeback whatsoever.
Well, of course, the danger, I mean, the place could go up.
But then people were smoking out in the yard, like, you know, there was no danger there, but you just weren't allowed to smoke. Now, that was at 12 o'clock at night when he came up and sacked him.
Really?
They were on the night shift. Yes. He was after being out at a party or something, and he came in, and of course he took a stroll up. His house was on the premises.
Yeah. He lived over the premises there.
Well, no, his house, it was on the grounds.
Yes. And so, yeah. But, you know, and the people when they came to work, like you said, it was all bikes or they walked.
Yeah.
So... at that time, you know, were there a lot of traffic? I mean, there was hardly any traffic, I suppose, after the war years.
Be no traffic, none whatsoever. Like, I can remember one fellow that had a motor car that worked in the mill. Everyone else was either walking or on bikes,
yeah,
push bikes. A few motorbikes. Some people were luckier than others.
Yeah, and... when, you know, the people who were transporting, say, the raw material, the trees, to Saggart, the forestry was nearby, wasn't it?
No. Yeah. It was pulp. It was wood pulp, which was an extract from the timber. But that came in from foreign countries.
And there was no pulping of the trees going on
there? Oh, no.
Was there not?
That only went on in Clondalkin.
It was in Clondalkin paper mills.
And so was there, I suppose it cut the work very short then, you know, when you had the pulp and...
Well, the pulp came in bales. They were quite big, you know, you wouldn't, I suppose the pulp would be nearly 200 weight each bale.
Yes.
And this is where the big machine...
Beater.
The beater. It beat the beater, just self-explanatory in a way. It beat the pulp up into, with all the other ingredients, turned it into a liquid, which was stored in big chests at the back of the wet end of the machine. It poured onto the wire then, which, known as the wet end, so you could imagine all the water that would be coming out of that. It went from that onto the cylinders, which dried it. Went from that onto the reel. One very interesting thing about Triplett was Jeff Smurfit, which would be Michael Smurfit's father. He used to come out in a little 2-ton truck, and he'd buy 2 and 3 pounds worth of waste out of the pond.
Which pond? No.
Do you see? When the ingredients were coming through to make the paper, there was a certain amount of waste which flowed, and it flowed into what's called a settling pond. This was a big pond outside, and it was full of all this waste.
Yes.
Jeff Smurfit would come and he'd shovel that up into his truck. He paid two. Mr. Hogbrook said to me, "You stand there and don't let him out of the yard until he pays. £3. Jeff Smurfit. Jeff Smurfit paid me the £3 with off down to his mill in Clonsky. And that was the start of him.
And what, did he have a place, Jeff?
Oh, he used to make cardboard, wasn't it?
Mm, yes. That's right.
My goodness, yeah.
And he used to buy the waste in Stripbrook.
Yeah.
Drove the truck himself and loaded himself.
Yes.
Wasn't afraid to do it either. That's a long way from Michael Smurfit now.
But talk to me about the river that flows there. It went through Clondalkin before it got to
no,
you.
No.
The other way around.
It came from the British ponds. That's about, Tommy will show you probably where it is. It's about 3 or 4 miles up the hill. Came down long. They used the water there in Saggart. Actually, it flows the back of our house down through Saggart.
That's right.
Down to the, and it flows into the Camac.
Yeah,
down in Clondalkin. Clondalkin used the water as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
Same water. Now there was Joe Dowling. He'd be controlling the water up at British to let it through, or when they needed water, he'd haul it up. Or so I don't really want to contact Joe or not.
Well, he'd be a very interesting contact too. So there was a kind of a reservoir there.
That's right. Yes.
And they released the water and it came down.
That's true.
And.
They had to control, because I don't understand it fully now, but I'd say probably in bad weather, like if there's a lot of rain, probably there was a lot of water, so they had to
release
so much and let it off or whatever. They had to control it anyway. Patsy Hannon would be another one.
Yeah. Tell me where was the water being used? Tell me how the water was being used in Saggart at the time.
It was one of the main ingredients in paper making. You used it in the beaters, you used it in the potchers. You used it all through. It was all like, you had these big chests which would be twice the height of this house, and they'd be full of this material that flowed onto the wire. But it was a liquid type stuff, you know, there's a lot of water in it. And the water, you see, there was the wire on the machine then was...
It was porous.
Wire was porous, but I'm trying to think of the material. What it was, copper.
Yes.
If you damaged the wire, you were nearly sacked. Mm. It was so expensive, one of these wires, because it would stretch. Mm. It would stretch, it should be about 6 or 8 feet wide and about 20 feet long, and it's rotated right around rolls.
I see, yes. And was it important that the water would be very clear?
Well...
that it was...
I couldn't answer that truthfully, but yes. To tell you the truth, I wouldn't think so, because you'd imagine it's coming down, it flows down to a river, so there had to be some way of cleaning it or some filtering system or something like that, I'd imagine.
Yeah.